Oh yeah. Whoops. Call the Finance, Interim Finance and Tax Committee to order. Will the clerk read the roll?
Senator Hoag. Senator Burkhardt.
Here.
Senator Cook.
Here.
Senator Dotsenrod.
Here.
Senator Lafine.
Here.
Senator Elke.
Here.
Senator Sorvag.
Here.
Representative Hedlund. Representative Ballou.
Here.
Representative Belter.
Here.
Representative Drubdahl.
Present.
Representative Rosseff.
Here.
Representative Hansen. Representative Hattelstead.
Here.
Representative Holman.
Here.
Representative Casper. Representative Meyer.
Here.
Representative Napey.
Here.
Representative Nelson.
Here.
Representative Owens.
Here.
Representative Straley.
Here.
We made it. It's quorum, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Committee members, I'm just the acting chairman this morning, and Representative Hedlund will take over upon his arrival. consideration of the minutes from the April 23rd meeting. Okay, we have a motion to approve the meeting, the minutes. Is there a second?
Second.
And a second.
Oh, who was the motion?
Representative Drubdahl.
Okay.
Okay,
we need to vote.
Okay, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Minutes are approved. Okay, we'll open with the 905 legislative council presentation on a property tax relief for residential property.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good morning. The bill draft should be the top one on the stack, 13.0088. This is a draft that the committee has not looked at. This is a new one. Senator Hoag asked for this draft to be put together and brought to the committee. Don't forget, we've got some other drafts that are still on the pile, but this is another alternative. This one follows a path similar to one of the drafts the committee has already considered. What it would do is, in addition to the mill levy reduction grant program, the 75 mill buy down for school levies, this would be in addition to that, and that is the basis for the fiscal estimate. This would provide for a primary residence with a CE, residential property only, a reduction that would cover the first, what it amounts to is $75,000, true and full value, that $3,375 of taxable value, that's $75,000, true and full. For that amount, the first $75,000 of value of a primary residence, the state would pay all of the property taxes levied against that residence through a mechanism very similar to the way the homestead credit is handled now, but obviously on a much bigger scale. In addition, beginning on line 10, for an individual 65 years of age or older, that reduction would be increased to $5,625 of taxable value, and that in true and full value numbers is $125,000. Okay. The beginning on line 13, if an individual is entitled to a reduction under this section, and there are two sections referenced there, 570208.1, that is the homestead credit available to individuals 65 years of age and older, or totally and permanently disabled, and the 57-02-08.8, that is the veterans credit for disabled veterans. Those credits would be applied first. If an individual is entitled to one or both of those would be applied to the property first, and then this reduction would be applied in addition. The second subsection there, beginning on line 19. Some farming and ranching residences are not exempt under the farm home exemption, depending on the kind of manner in which the home is owned. Some farming and ranching operations are not the traditional dad runs the farm, dad owns the house, and so on. Various kinds of ownership have come into being where that residence might be owned by a limited liability company or a family farming corporation or something, and we found that out in 2007 with the income tax credit that we missed quite a few of those kinds of residences with the credit. This section would allow the reduction for those kinds of property, and of course farm homes that are exempt from property tax would not need this credit because that exemption would continue to apply. The rest of the language of the bill is very similar to what the committee has looked at in a bill draft that was previously considered. On page 2, line 14, it would be required that an individual claiming this credit file an annual claim for the credit. Once that claim is filed and passes muster, that credit would remain in effect for that entire taxable year, even if that home is sold to someone else. And it was suggested that for administrative purposes, it would be very difficult to figure out what to do with that credit if a sale is made later on. So it would apply for that year. But regardless whether there's a sale or not, it's only good to the end of that year, and the individual has to again apply the following year. Some of the information that is required here is also similar to what the committee has looked at before. A Social Security or taxpayer identification number would have to be filed, and this would allow for verification that nobody is getting this credit against more than one property. The Social Security number information is protected by the language in the draft that it would not become public information, that it is only available for purposes of administering this credit. There is a penalty provision of sorts on page 3, beginning at line 7. If an applicant claims and gets a reduction from more than one primary residence, all of those are canceled and treated as omitted property and put back on the tax roll, so the individual loses the credit for that year and two more years. That individual can't claim the credit for the next 2 years. That's the penalty for trying to cheat. Let's see. On line 23, definition of a primary residence, has to be owned and occupied as a primary residence as of the assessment date. That's February 1. So on February 1, your residence is fixed. Wherever you're living on February 1, that's where you can claim this credit. The rest of the draft relates to how the money changes hands, the determination from the state of how much money goes out and where it goes, and then how it gets to the county level and then is distributed among taxing districts. And of course, the big question everybody wants is on line 25. The estimated cost of this credit, $384 million. And as I said, that is in addition to the mill levy reduction grant program, which at 75 mills, I think the number was $395 million. So this would be in addition to that, and the combination of the two programs obviously would provide a very substantial amount of tax relief for residential property. So that's kind of the quick and dirty summary. If there are any questions, I can address them.
John, I guess one of the questions I'd have is how is new property handled? Because if this bill would, I guess if this bill would pass, we would essentially not need the, like the new home exemptions that some of the cities now allow.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it may not completely eliminate the potential value of those kinds of credits. It would substantially reduce the tax load for those kinds of properties. Now, if it is a new home and it is not a completed taxable structure on February 1st, but at some point later in the year, I'm not exactly sure if a partial structure on February 1 is assessed. I suppose it's taxed at whatever the value of it is on that date, if it's just a poured foundation or something. But there would still be some value to that new single-family residential credit or exemption that can be provided by cities or counties. For whatever value that property has beyond this $75,000, and then the mill levy reduction grant reduction in the tax against that, there would still be some residual value and tax liability that could be forgiven by cities or counties, even with both of the programs in place.
Okay, thank you. Representative Drubdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And John, I have to admit, I haven't had much of a chance to review this. But on page 2, subsection 5, line 14, for some reason a lot of red flags go up on that particular thing. And I don't know why, if it's because of the paperwork that's going to be involved in it, or I just don't understand how a credit would work. It appears to me that if I was a homeowner on February or March 1st, I'd go in and claim that's my home, so I would get my $125,000 exemption. But and then if I turned around and sold that house on June 1st June 30th and bought another house, another location, how would I, get my whole $125,000 for the first 6 months, and then I go to the next one, and when I use it, when you buy another house, you prorate the taxes for the period of the year that you own the house? And if the house is valued $125,000 total to start with, I would have a use exemption in one, and yet no exemption on the other, and a lot of paperwork in between. I don't know, it's confusing because of, it just looks like just a lot of paperwork caused by that statement, since we're already filing the paperwork that we changed ownership.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drumdahl, I think the situation you described is the reason that it was suggested that this exemption, once attached to a home, remains with that home for the balance of the year, so that it doesn't follow the taxpayer moving to a new place. It stays with the home, and the new buyer presumably will be that will be their primary residence, so they would enjoy that benefit for the portion of the year they reside there. The person who sells and perhaps buys another home, if it's an existing home, that credit will be there. If it was someone else's primary residence that they bought, if it's a newly constructed home, it would probably be only subject to a partial assessment if it wasn't done on February 1. So I think the view is that doing it this way is smoother than trying to follow the owner from place to place, attaching the exemption to the house.
Mr. Chairman, and if I may, it seems to be that in many ways, but for the paperwork involved in it, for the assessor's office, it seemed to me it would be, would enhance their work considerably to continue following this through.
Well, I believe the idea was that this would make it easier for assessors, that they don't have to follow people around as they trade residences. Maybe Marcy could give you a better answer.
I'd be interested in hearing. Thank you.
Senator Sarbog?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, just a quick question. If you're going to do it that way and you fix the exemption for somebody 70 years old and somebody 30 buys their house in August, do they, since the exemption stays with the property as it was certified, do they get the extra exemption then for the rest of the year, even if they aren't old enough? And if the senior citizen bought a home from a 30-year-old, then they're going to pay more? Or is there a provision or idea that you'd adjust that? Since we're not changing it for buyers, you're going to be mixing up the exemption with the age at some point, I would think.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sarbog, there is no adjustment, so it would be to your benefit to buy a home from an older person.
For 1 year.
For 1 year, yes.
Representative Roseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, I imagine there'd be a lot of different scenarios coming from this, but I don't see any provision on rental property. But say if I owned a 12-plex and live in one of those units, is there going to be a partial exemption then for that unit the owner lives in?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and maybe this is a question for Marcy too, if that unit is not an apartment unit, but is owned, it has to be owned and occupied. If it's like a condominium unit, then that unit for that individual would be entitled to this credit.
Senator Cook.
Chairman, isn't it safe to assume that a lot of these benefits that would be tied to tax deductions that would be tied to a piece of property would properly come into the negotiations on what that property sold for. If I was selling a piece of property that had a $125,000 exemption on it for 1 year, got a value of $3,000, safe to assume that as I gave that up, I might get $2,000 more for the property. And that ultimately, the concerns that people have with the exemptions would just be handled between the buyer and the seller.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, I don't know if that was a question or a statement, but I agree. I think that's the way it would work out, and whether that's good or bad, I don't know. I think it would be handled by the transaction.
Well, maybe it was a statement. That's what I would think it would be handled by that. But then one other question. How many definitions in Century Code do we have right now for primary residence?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, I don't know if there are any others other than the one that's here.
I kind of think there are others, and I wonder if maybe it wouldn't be wise to, before we look at this at a future meeting, do a little research on that. I'm thinking of school funding, or as far as what school is responsible for children. Thinking of voting. I'm thinking of income tax purposes. Maybe we can just do a little search, please.
Representative Nathie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, what's the reason for having somebody apply for this for year after year? I would think once you apply for it, I mean, who doesn't want a tax credit year after year? Why is there a reason why you have in here that they apply every year? I mean, why isn't one time good enough until the sale or until a transfer of property?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathie, I don't recall. It was suggested that that would be the best way to handle it, but I don't recall the reason. If it's to make sure that credits aren't going to people who shouldn't be getting them.
But wouldn't that be hashed out during when they apply for this? I mean, wouldn't that already be determined?
Well, I'm not sure that assessors are going to have that information fed into, I'm not sure. Once again, maybe Marcy's a better person to address that question.
Okay. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Walstead, under this draft, farm residents that are exempt currently, would they be taxed under this draft?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Meyer, no. They would be left in the status they are now, which is exempt from property taxes entirely.
And then a second question on page 3, under your primary residence definition, we have so many senior citizens that reside in Arizona, Florida, wherever. If they are not in there on February 1st, are they eligible for the credit or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Meyer, the individual, if that is the individual's primary residence, if they're living in Arizona 12 months, then they probably would not get the credit. It would probably not be considered their primary residence, but residency is a state of mind, really, rather than physical location.
You mentioned the February 1st date, and say you have someone who's living in Arizona for 3 months, and you listed February 1st as the assessment date of the taxable year. So if they've lived during the winter months, or 3 or 4 months, is that clarified at all?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Meyer, I don't think there's an issue there. The February 1 is the assessment date. That is the date that we look at the value of the property. If the individual is not physically in that structure on February 1, that would not be the determining factor of whether that is the individual's primary residence. You may be gone from your primary residence from time to time, but it doesn't change the fact that it is your primary residence. But if we find out you're claiming one of these in Arizona and in North Dakota, then you have a problem.
Senator Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see some inherent problems. One is that this only covers one, favors one property over another. But the yearly filing, when I was on county commission for the farm home exemption, was could turn into be a real problem. And here you're going to have thousands of residents that maybe won't get that filed on time. They don't know. They get a letter. Sometimes they don't open them. That's hard to believe, but that's very, very possible if you've ever worked with people. And here comes the 1st of March. They're not going to get it unless they go through a lot of hoops to get it. And that's going to be, I think, a real problem in administrating this. But I really have a problem with just one property getting this much tax relief, and like agriculture and farmland, which is close to a fourth of the assessed evaluation of property in the state of North Dakota, won't really get any out of this, or any other properties either. So it's just residential, and I think that's inherently wrong.
Senator Laughlin, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, John, there's nothing in here that prohibits a local municipality then from raising mills to just sort of offset what the relief we gave?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Laughlin, no. There's nothing in here that prohibits that, but the statutory mill levy limitations that exist would still be in place, so it wouldn't be possible to just raise the mill rate so the state is paying taxes and the homeowner is still paying taxes.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, the bill talks about taxable value, and I'm more used to working with full and true value and assessed value and stuff. Which is one of those equivalent to taxable value, or what is taxable value?
Well, you're not alone. I have the same problem, and I've been doing this for a long time. True and full value is the number that we think that's what our home is worth. It's market value, basically. Assessed value is 50% of that, and for residential property, taxable value is 9% of assessed value. So taxable value is 4.5% of market value. And that's all laid out in statute. Now, to make this easier to read, we could stop using the references to taxable value and just plug in true and full. So it would say $75,000, $125,000, and might make it a lot more reader friendly.
Yeah, that $75,000, then what does that translate into dollars of exemption? You know, just like you said, the bill kind of changes. When it's talking about the senior citizen, it's talking about $5,400 or whatever. But here we're talking about $75,000. How do they equate?
Well, when you translate 75 and 125 into taxable value, then it's the numbers that are here. $3,375 is taxable value is $75,000 of true and full value. So yeah, it's confusing.
Okay, and then I just had one more thing. I wasn't as worried about Arizona as I was about the people living in nursing homes. And how long, when you live in a nursing home, the bill talks about occupying your home, where would we draw the line on something like that?
If you look at page two of the draft, beginning on line four, this reduction continues to apply if the individual does not reside in their primary residence, if the individual's absence is due to confinement in a nursing home, hospital, or other care facility, as long as that confinement lasts, and as long as the portion of the primary residence that was normally occupied by that individual isn't rented out to someone else. And that provision is in the other draft that, that the committee has looked at also.
So can you still qualify for the, like, we're excluding rental property, but we've got homes sometimes where like half the home is rented. Can they get the credit and still rent half their home?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, in that circumstance, the assessment is it split, Marcy, based on the portion occupied?
Not if it's a residential, both portions. If it were rented through a beauty shop or something.
Then it would be. But if you rent out your basement to somebody.
That doesn't change your residential classification.
Okay, so then if you rent your basement to somebody, this exemption would apply against the entire structure.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other, Representative Nathie?
One quick question, thanks, Mr. Chairman. John, so if I'm in a nursing home and a hospital, it's incumbent upon me to reapply every year? And if I'm not able, if I'm dealing with physical or whatever health issues.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathie, yes, it would be necessary for you or your legal representative on your behalf to make that application annually.
Okay, one more question and we want to move on to 915. Senator Kelly.
Representative Kelly. Representative,
excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And John, somebody that lives in a home in a town and then has a lake home, they're about 6 months in each one, you know, back and forth maybe, but how are you going to determine which one? They'll take the most expensive one, which is very likely the lake home, nowadays anyway. And is that going to be the way it would be? They could have choose either one, or they can choose their the house that they want to consider the primary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelsch, yeah, I think that would be the way it would have to work, that you make that choice, but there could be consequences. You may, electing one as your primary residence, change where you vote. And if you're a legislator, it might move you out of, move you out of your district.
Okay, let's move on to the 915 presentation by Jerry Coleman. Mr. Coleman.
It is now, okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Jerry Coleman with the Department of Public Instruction. I'll be working off of a handout that you should already have. It's titled NDCC 5764 Mill Levy Reduction Allocation and Grant. What I was asked to do was to put together a fiscal effect of providing 185 mills of property tax relief through the same type of program that already exists, the 75 mill program. So the way I approached it was that I continued our current max relief program of 75 mills, and then I added to that an extension of another 110 mills. So if you look at the
60 mills reduction, or 50, and some even less, and some only 65, or was this just a general layout of how much property tax reduction there would be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Representative Kelsch, I just continued the existing program, so if they were only getting 65, they continued to only get 65, and then we did that second tier to go up to 110 of what they were levying currently.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Jerry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we'll move forward then to the 925 presentation by the Tax Department on the Cisco analysis of information for bill drafts under consideration.
Morning. Morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ryan Rauschenberger with the Office of State Tax Commissioner. My testimony this morning will be in reference to the 905 bill draft and just give some background to the estimated fiscal cost of that bill. First, I'd like to start off by thanking Terry Traynor from the Association of Counties for all the work that he did in actually sampling counties and coming up with the primary residence information that went into the $384 million cost of the 905 bill draft. The $384 million number was generated by sampling seven counties, three urban counties and four rural counties. Cass, Grand Forks, Ward County, Ramsey McLean, Henninger, and Divide County were all sampled. And those seven counties represent over 40% of the total residential property tax base in the state. So it's a very good sample size. So we're pretty comfortable with the numbers that we've come up with. They were also selected because they do have residential property valuation information.
The changes to mobile home assessment and taxation would be easier to accomplish and would involve fewer properties than option one. The changes in option two would apply only to mobile homes that are not presently assessed as real property. For 2011, counties reported a total of $3,845,000 levied on 16,294 permit-based mobile homes. I personally lived in two mobile homes over a period of 20 years in New York State, Connecticut, Wisconsin, South Dakota, and North Dakota from 1963 to 1983. At the time I lived in each state, New York and Connecticut had no mobile home tax. Wisconsin charged only a school tax based on the size of the mobile home and collected monthly by the owner of the mobile home court. South Dakota had property tax on mobile homes, which I was told was for the prior year. And North Dakota had the old mobile home decal tax, which is similar to today's permit system, except the mobile home now no longer is required to have a decal on the outside of it. The National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Law is currently drafting a Manufactured Housing Act. And the note with that is the Act's primary focus is the proper classification of manufactured homes, also commonly called mobile homes, as real property or personal property. The Act is intended to modernize the law in this area, bring uniformity and clarity into a chaotic area of state law, to increase the supply of affordable housing by making financing more available and affordable, and to provide manufactured homeowners with many of the same legal protections as owners of site-built homes. The most recent draft of the proposed legislation from the conference appears to be less controversial than earlier versions. The 2011 legislature enacted Section 47-1027, which sets out procedures for conversion of a mobile home to real property by means of an affidavit of affixation. Requirements are similar to those in Section 57-55-10-2C. Reconciling the existing differences between taxation of mobile homes and taxation of real property would be a step toward desired uniformity. And that concludes my prepared testimony, but I'll be glad to try to answer any questions.
Okay, are there any questions? Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marcy, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of crew housing facilities that are coming in. Have they prepaid? I'm assuming they're mobile homes under this definition. Or are they being assessed as real property?
Representative Meyer, excuse me, that was addressed by the last legislative session. They are not real property, and they are also not mobile homes. They don't meet the definition of mobile homes. So the legislature set up a provision for the city or county in which those facilities are located to charge a permit fee for them, which is negotiated between the political subdivision and the owners or operators of these residential facilities. It's not a property tax, it's not a mobile home tax, it's a permit that theoretically does not exceed the cost of the home itself, is not subject to special assessment.
No, but I was thinking of, like, if there was a mobile home that wasn't on a permanent foundation where the person did own the property, it's still classified as a mobile home, right?
If it were not on a permanent foundation and the property was owned by the same person, it's still, if it has to be on a permanent foundation to be considered real property. And I will admit that there's a lot of violation of that at various areas. I mean, especially around some of the lakes, we have cabins that started out as mobile homes. They're still just sitting on blocks, and they've built an extension, a real property type extension around them, and they're misclassified, and it isn't as efficiently handled as it could be.
Well, thank you.
Representative Dotson.
Mr. Chairman and Marcy, your last paragraph there on page 5, you talk about the 2011 legislature, and we enacted 471027, which sets out a procedure to convert a mobile home, manufactured home, to real property. Any mobile home that uses those provisions and does that conversion, does on that mobile home, does that solve the problem of this taxes being paid for the year ahead on that particular home, or do we still have that for those mobile homes?
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dotson-Arad, once an affidavit of affixation has been filed and recorded, then that is considered real property. And you don't have to file one of those affidavits in order for the home to be considered real property. If it is on a foundation and the same individual owns the property, it is real property under North Dakota law. The affidavit of affixation was actually promoted by this conference that I was quoting from, and they were trying to get that type of legislation in all states to have uniformity. But in North Dakota, we already have the similar provisions to what they put in there. The requirements to complete the affidavit and record it are similar to our requirements for making it real property. It didn't change much, it just kind of formalized it.
Representative Nathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marcy, just to switch gears a little bit, getting back to the bill draft here, and back to my question earlier about as far as applying for the credit every year. Can you speak to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathy, it would be more paperwork, obviously, for the counties. And if this has to go through the tax department, which I'm sure it would, you know, in order to get the reimbursement funds out to the counties and all, we know how much time it takes just to do the homestead credit and the veterans credit. To do all of the residential property in North Dakota is going to be extremely time consuming, and we'd have to really look at these dates to see if it's even feasible without hiring additional staff. But the counties would, and the cities, the major cities have a lot of homestead credits, but if they had every residential property in the city, I'm sure that would be quite a burden, and I see at least one assessor from the major city is here. He might be able to give you a better idea of it.
Would this be doable just to apply once a year? I mean, once my home, I come and apply in March and then I'm done. I mean, would this process work better that way?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathy, I think the annual application would be more likely to catch changes in homeowners that might otherwise be missed. I mean, ordinarily, when a deed is recorded, the assessor is aware of it and changes in ownership are noted. But the annual application is what we require for other types of exemptions, but those generally are on a basis where some situation can change from one year to the other. If there's an income requirement, like for the homestead credit, you might qualify one year, you might not qualify another year. This doesn't have any income requirement, but the age requirement, once you hit 65, you better run in there and reapply because you get a better break.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you, Marcy. Representative Proseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In order to change this, do we need a bill draft now so it can be reviewed by this committee? I'm asking.
I'm not, to change what?
Well, to change the timing of the assessment, unlike on Marcy's option two. Yeah.
Yep, we don't have one pending.
We have to ask to have a bill draft made then. I would suggest we have a bill draft made to mirror Marcy's option two on page three.
Okay, we have a motion from Representative Proseth for a bill draft to deal with the issue he just pointed out. Is there a
second?
Second. Second from Senator Cook. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Okay, let's move on to the 950 committee discussion and staff directives on property tax relief issues. Any other issues?
Mr. Chairman.
Where are we? Oh, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to throw this out here for discussion, I guess. Wouldn't it be easier, instead of every single bill draft we have, there's way more problems than they solve for the most part on this property tax issue. Wouldn't it just be easier to completely remove the school levy, increase the per pupil payment to whatever it needs to be, $10,000 or whatever the number is, and call it good? What's the downside of doing it, just simplifying it and removing the levy, banning it, increasing the per pupil payment, completely fund education and move on to the next issue?
Any discussion on Representative Straley's comments? Senator Cook?
Mr. Chairman, there is another committee. It's a joint committee of the Taxation and Education, and I think that committee was put together jointly like that to investigate that path. I think they're kind of waiting for Measure 2 to be decided on, but there's an issue of local control there. The state's going to fund everything. Where are the local decisions made on what the cost of education is? I think that there could be an effort for the state to fund 100% of the core education policy and then leave other items that are not identified in core education as a responsibility of a local school district. But I think that other committee is going to be going down that road.
To me, I guess, Mr. Chairman, to me, I think that seems simpler. Why should a child get more in, say, South Fargo as opposed to Rugby, just based on property valuations alone? Shouldn't we know what the cost of education is, average statewide, funded at that level? Everybody's on an even playing field. Doesn't matter if you live in a school district that has huge property tax valuations or wind farms. Simplify this, get rid of all this property tax issue, we reduce it by 45%. Everybody should be fairly happy. Thank you.
Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just throw in another idea related to Senator Cook's just taking over the funding entirely. Just to give you a quick example, if you look at the third school there, Barnes County North, right now they are in the process of building a brand new school. And they did that by merging three school districts, and they're getting rid of three old 1910 schools, which all the small towns all have these old schools yet. And they found that the savings in going into one building was enough to pay for the building. And I'll just give you an example. and where this is leading. They have a $4 million budget every year, this school district does. And by discarding their three old schools and building a new one, they shave $1 million off their operating every year. And after 20 years, that school will be paid for, and they'll get that $1 million of savings every year ongoing after that, and they'll still have a relatively brand-new building. There's a lot of waste in all of those small school districts out there. There's 80 school districts that have less than 240 students. That's only 20 students to a teacher. If we're going to take over funding, it'd be nice to drive some more efficiency in that system somehow. And I think we could do that if we, somebody, some organization statewide starts having a little more control in the school funding. I know that takes all the local control away. Some people will say that's blasphemy, but literally a third to or more, 40% of our school districts have way too many buildings, way too old buildings, and way too many staff running them.
Thank you. I think that your comments probably also apply to some of our city schools also. Any other comments? Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I pretty well agree that property tax relief needs to be general property tax relief, not just on one class of property. And I think Marcy pointed out that even mobile homes or trailers, as we like to call them, were not even taken into consideration. There's a lot of things that weren't taken into consideration. I'd have some comments on the school policy also, but we'll probably save them for another time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, if not, committee members, I think we'll take a 15-minute break then, and let's come back in at 10:30. Okay, we'll start with the 10:30 agenda, a presentation by the Legislative Council on a memorandum on property tax exemption history.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, the question was raised at the last committee meeting about a chronology for property tax exemptions that the committee could look at. Some of these exemptions have existed really forever. Some of them are probably required constitutionally or by the Enabling Act. But the memo lays out a chronology, and it was kind of interesting putting it together and digging through some of those old books that you have to blow the dust off of. Back in 1862, we got our first property tax here in Dakota Territory, and at that time there was a property tax to support the operation of the territorial government, a mill and a half, two mills that went to counties, and one that was designated for roads and bridges. Being new at the game and looking through that legislation, it's kind of hard to see all of the administrative steps that we have in place now. But at the time, exemptions were provided for property owned by the United States, obviously, Dakota Territory and political subdivisions, and cemeteries and land and buildings of literary and scientific institutions, and benevolent agricultural and religious institutions. In 1889, we became a state. A new constitution was approved, and that constitution had exemptions for property of the United States and the state of North Dakota. You'll notice political subdivisions were not exempted under that provision. And that the Legislative Assembly, by a general law, shall exempt property used exclusively for school, religious, cemetery, or charitable purposes. So the literary, scientific, and agricultural from the earlier provision was not included. In 1890, the state legislative assembly met for the first time and created statutory exemptions, which are listed there. There are some limitations. One, in the first one, it's got schools, houses used exclusively for public worship, and the lots or parts of lots upon which houses are erected. Okay? Lots or parts of lots set up arguments, obviously. And, last legislative assembly, that argument was still boiling. So, a lot of these, they're old, but it doesn't mean they're settled. Buildings belonging to counties were exempted, not exceeding 10 acres. Now, the constitutional provision of 1889 doesn't say anything about political subdivisions, and it doesn't say the legislature can grant property tax exemptions, so that exemption for counties, in my opinion, was subject to challenge. I don't know if it ever was. I can't find anything, but that grant to counties doesn't comply with the Constitution that was in place at the time in my book. Here's another thing in sub 6 there. Public charities, etc., etc. All land owned or occupied by agricultural societies not exceeding 80 acres. Okay, agricultural societies, I don't see the Constitution saying that that could be exempted, and I also don't see that there was any authority to limit that to 80 acres of property. So, wish I would have been a lawyer back in 1890. 1901, we got into the church property thing again, and the legislature decided 1 acre of property was enough for church property. Exemption was also created for charitable associations, posts, lodges, chapters, councils, etc., etc., like fraternal organizations, military organizations, those kinds of things. In 1911, an exemption was created. I didn't list it here. In 1914, the voters approved a constitutional amendment that finally put into the Constitution an exemption for property of political subdivisions. 1918, that was kind of a happening election, political change. One of the changes was that instead of the legislature shall by law exempt certain kinds of property, the exemption was put into the Constitution, so it doesn't even have to be taken care of statutorily. It is an exemption for school, religious, cemetery, charitable, or other public purposes, shall be exempt from taxation. The thing about the legislative assembly doing this by law was removed.
All as I used to be.
I didn't want to interrupt you.
Yeah, where were we? 1918, the constitutional amendment allowed the legislature to designate certain buildings as personal property and to exempt those buildings from taxation. In 1919, that was implemented by the legislature creating an exemption for all structures and improvements on agricultural lands. Another issue we're still talking about today, but that exemption has been in place since then. Not all of this is worth focusing on. 1931, telecommunications carriers received a property tax exemption and became subject to gross receipts taxes. At that time, those were mutual and cooperative telephone companies, and there were privately owned companies that were not subject to that kind of tax, but the legislature in 1999 ruled all telecommunications carriers into that kind of tax treatment, a gross receipts tax instead of property tax. 1937, housing authorities received a property tax exemption, much earlier than I would have guessed. 1953, we got oil and gas production tax in place of property tax on mineral interests for producing oil and gas. Uh, 1969, that was a big year. Personal property was exempted from property taxes, except for certain designated kinds of personal property. The first discretionary exemption was created in 1969. Property of new and expanding businesses, Chapter 4057.1 was created. The city or the county could grant exemptions for certain new business enterprises. And the homestead credit was created in 1969. The credit that pays part of the property tax bill for individuals 65 or older, or permanently and totally disabled. Initially it was just 65 and older, with limited income and assets. 1973, not a discretionary exemption, but an exemption for improvements to commercial and residential buildings, and tax increment financing district property. 1973, the legislation was created that allows those kinds of financing mechanisms through the property tax. Let's look at 1980. This was a constitutional amendment eliminating property taxes for state purposes. Now, as you know, the state levies one mill for the state medical center. That's the only levy the state is allowed by the Constitution to impose. And that happened in 1980. Prior to that, the state did have authority to levy a property tax statewide. 1983. That was the origin of the exemption that cities or counties may use to exempt up to, well, at that time it was $75,000, now it's $150,000 of true and full value of new single family and condominium and townhouse residential property. 1985, one of the probably most pointless efforts, conditional wetlands exemption was created, but it was made subject to funding provided by legislative appropriation. It didn't happen then, and it has never happened since. So we've got a chapter of law that could be funded by the legislature, but never has been. 1999, Renaissance Zone property. An exemption that cities can grant was created. Well, I won't run through the rest of those on that page. In 2009, a couple of significant changes. One, new single-family residential property that the builder still owns. An exemption was created to deal with an economic circumstance that existed at that time where builders were building properties and having trouble moving them. Also, disabled veteran credit based on a total disability rating of the VA was created. So that's the chronology. And then part of this agenda item also is to review a bill draft. It's a pretty short bill draft, but it is pretty far-reaching. 13.0081. All it has in it is a repeal section. It repeals chapters 4057.1, that is the new business and industry discretionary exemption for cities or counties. Chapter 4058, that is the chapter, it's the urban renewal law, and it contains the provisions for tax increment financing. 4063, that is the chapter for Renaissance zone treatment. The entire chapter is repealed. Mostly the purpose of it is to allow property tax exemptions. It also has a provision in it for an income tax exemption that the state grants. I just took out the whole chapter, kind of figured that that income tax exemption standing by itself wouldn't make any sense, because without a Renaissance zone, the exemption wouldn't exist. So, and then it repeals four subsections of 570208. That is the section that has the long list of property tax exemptions. Subsection 35 is the city or county exemption of up to $150,000 of value of single-family residential or condominium or townhouse property. Subsection 36 is a discretionary exemption for property used to provide early childhood services. Subsection 37 is a discretionary exemption for pollution abatement improvements. Subsection 42 is the exemption for the home still owned by the builder. And then Chapter 5702.2 is that up to 5-year exemption for improvements to residential or commercial property. I've made copies here of the statutory provisions. I will pass those out to you so you can see what they look like. The problem with the repeal bill is you don't see any of the language that's disappearing. But I did want to point out the effective date clause. The act would be effective for tax years, well, beginning with 2013. However, the provisions of law being repealed remain effective for the duration of an exemption granted by a city or county under those provisions when they were in effect. So if you received a 5-year exemption, that 5-year exemption would continue to run for its duration, even if it's 2013, 14, 15, and so on. So with that, I'll pass out copies of the statutory provisions and then stand ready for the onslaught of questions.
While John's passing this out, everyone, I would like to apologize for my little mishap of mixing up the days, but are there any questions on the memorandum or the bill draft? Representative Nathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, does this bill apply to nonprofits, hospitals, those kind of people?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathan, no. That is not discretionary. That is a constitutional and statutory exemption that is not granted by local government.
Any other discussion? Representative Striley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I, of course, think this bill is fantastic, but outside of maybe the early childhood services, if you look at when these things were put in place, 1973, TIF districts, 1983, new construction, which I find to be one of the strangest pieces in here at this current interest rate environment, rates were much higher, and these, you had to entice people to build. We don't have those issues now or in the foreseeable future. So I would strongly support this, and if you're ready to entertain a motion.
Representative Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, on that particular one, item 36, the child care, that deals with corporate facilities that are set up for child care and adult, is what it just read. It exempted private residences used for child care. My question is, do you recall off the top of your head if we have a income tax deduction or credit for corporate that sets up child care facilities?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Owens, no, we do not.
We do not, okay.
I've had legislation that would have done that, but it didn't pass.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chairman and John, in 1901 we had religious property. You could have 1 acre to be exempt. Has that been changed in the last few years? I remember a bill, but I don't know if it passed or not.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, it was passed. It made some changes. I'm going to ask Senator Cook for some help. Is it 2 acres plus the footprint?
I've been doing everything in my power since the last session to forget about that bill, so I just don't have to ask me any questions.
Well, and my recollection of it is fuzzed up by the fact that I wrote about 40 different amendments with different acreage, and I don't recall what the final one was.
I think it was 4 or 5. It's, I don't know. It,
oh, Marcy knows for sure. Okay.
I knew that.
There's the simple answer.
Representative Drubdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And John, as was pointed out, a number of these exemptions were put through during slow times in North Dakota when our population was going backwards, such as the exemptions for new buildings and new homes and remodeling and reclaiming old parts of cities. Now that things have turned around, do we have any indication of how much of these exemptions are currently being utilized by the city? I think these are discretionary, and they're not mandatory exemptions, and the cities have to pass them on before they're utilized. Do we have any idea if there's still, if any of the towns or cities or counties are feeling the need to give 5 years exemptions on new homes, for instance, sir?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drubdahl, we've from time to time in the past done surveys on that, but I don't think any of those are recent enough to be reliable. Maybe that would be a good question to maybe ask the cities and counties to address for the committee, look into the level of use of those.
Representative Froseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, if Measure 2 passes, what happens to all these chapters that are being repealed here, do they automatically go away, or is that part of the process that we have to go through at the next session and repeal all these?
Report. So, now, with those issues in mind, and given the fact that I'm not a bond attorney and needed some help on some of these issues, I've been visiting with Mr. Scott Wagner, and he was good enough to agree to come in and talk with the committee today, the next item on the agenda, on reporting of bonded debt. And I also asked him the question, if Measure 2 passes, what is the future of political subdivision debt? So that's the next topic.
Any questions of John before we move into Mr. Wagner's presentation? Well, welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Mr.
Go ahead.
Difficult. So I went, and true, I had a lady there at that time that wasn't quite as busy, but she said, it's a simple process. It's all right here. So whether you should look up how much your neighbors borrowed or not, I you know, that's just kind of an interesting little thing you want to do. But I was just, it's just that the information is there. And if a person's interested, whereas I don't think the legislators are going to read a quarterly report of 2,100 political subdivisions. That's why I think the information's there. None of it is secret. And if you're interested in it, you can go and you can get it. I just think we're putting a burden on these political subdivisions that we don't need to do. It's one more thing they've got to do.
Representative Belter.
My comment to that would be that it's been my experience that women can find things and men can't.
Representative Stradley, do you have a question? Well, committee, Senator Dotson.
Mr. Chairman, and, you know, it seems to me we got started on this because of some of the controversy around tax increment financing. That in over the last 2 years or 4 years, there was so this would be primarily in the cities of the state, that it became an issue of questions of how much are we obligated for. To what degree are the taxpayers in the taxing district, which ultimately this is a property tax issue. Those people in that taxing district ultimately become the backers and they're ultimately responsible. So this issue came up and in that process, in inquiring with the tax department and other agencies, it became pretty clear that nobody knew this, that there was no place in the state bureaucracy that anybody kept track of it. There were subdivisions around the state that were had levels of debt, and some were quite high and some were not. But I think that's how we got to this point, is there was an awareness that we had a lot of subdivisions getting into fairly significant amount of borrowing and debt and obligations, and no one could really go put their finger on what that was, and ultimately I viewed it as a property tax issue, that if the state had some interest here, if we're going to obligate the property owners within these taxing districts, as a state policymaker, there ought to be some awareness. Bonded indebtedness per capita can really rise in some cases to be quite onerous. In the late 70s and early 80s, we had bonded indebtedness because of the boom and then bust in the oil industry. There were curb and gutter and paving projects that had been taken on, and then there was nobody there to pay them, and the property owners were kind of left. And really, the state sort of at that time had a hands-off attitude. that these are matters for those subdivisions. They can manage themselves. But there it seemed like there was a lack of awareness in the legislature about, and at the state level, what these levels of debt were. So I think that's how we got started down this track of trying to find a way for the state and policymakers to have some idea, to some awareness. And it does seem to me that it shouldn't be that difficult to do. We do have central reporting now, I think, on all borrowing. I mean, if you go to the borrow on a farm loan, I think there's central reporting. I think that goes to the courthouse, it's registered, and then other borrowers are aware around the state that loan has been taken and their security has been taken on a crop or on land. So I'm a little puzzled why it's so difficult for us to find this and keep track of it. It seems to me it should almost be a simple matter and not expensive and not time-consuming. And maybe I don't understand it well enough to know that it is going to be a burden. But and if this information is out there, as Mr. Wegman says, maybe we could get to it and find it without burdening anybody. But I do think that the legislature ought to be aware of it. If we are burdening, if subdivisions of the state are accumulating debt, it does seem like it's something that's going to be the obligation of the property owners. I think there is a state interest in knowing that information.
Well, I would agree with you, and I think we're going to find out with Senator Cook's suggestion just what kind of a process it takes. Anything else in this area? Not. Let's move to the next item. Miles?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Miles Vosburgh, Director of the Tax Administration Division of the Tax Department, and I've been asked to give a brief update on the streamlined sales tax project. I have just four short areas to cover. I will talk about the registrations through the central registration system, collection of tax revenue through that system, current activities that the governing board and the committees are carrying on, and some anticipated legislation. As of today, we have 272 companies that have registered through the central streamlined sales tax registration system. That system allows a retailer at any location to register for all of the streamlined states to register and collect tax. 72 of those companies have indicated they don't anticipate having sales in North Dakota, so we have approximately 200 companies that have registered through the system and collecting tax. Through those 200 companies, since the inception of the streamline agreement in October of 2005 through March 31st of this year, North Dakota has collected approximately $29.8 million of North Dakota and local tax from those 200 vendors. Approximately $6.6 million of that tax is from retailers that volunteered to collect tax here in North Dakota and have no obligation to do so. About $3.9 million is from retailers that did have a legal obligation to register and collect tax, and about $19.2 million of the total came from retailers that were already registered in North Dakota before the central registration system was up and running. And I would add that, you know, that revenue keeps increasing each quarter. For the last two quarters in a row, the voluntary collections from those retailers that didn't have a requirement here have exceeded $450,000 each of the last two quarters. And so it is growing to be a substantial amount of funds. As far as current activities that are going on through the governing board and its committees, some of the things that we're working on, one of the issues is credits for taxes paid to another state. Not all states are consistent in the amount of credit that they provide to someone who has paid tax in another state on a purchase and then moved the product or service to another state. And if the second state has a higher rate than where the tax was originally paid, then they owe the additional tax, but generally not, you know, they get credit for the tax that they already paid to another state. Some of the issues there, for example, are what taxes are included. For example, North Dakota has a motor vehicle excise tax, a farm machinery gross receipts tax. We would provide credit for states that have similar taxes to that, but it's not a sales and use tax. They bring something to North Dakota and they owe tax. Another example is if both sales and use tax, if credit is given for both taxes. Some states in the past have only given credit for a sales tax that was paid on the original transaction, but not on use tax that was required to be paid because the retailer didn't collect the tax or the product was moved to another state. Just because there's some inconsistencies there, the states are looking at that issue to try to avoid any double taxation or an individual or a company having to pay tax more than once on the same product. Discount vouchers are another topic that we're currently discussing. You may be familiar with Groupon or Social Living, some of the sales that are made over the internet, where a company will come forward and say, if we can get 500 customers to take this particular transaction, you'll get it at a certain price, which is normally substantially less than the original price. And these companies have been asking the various states how they tax those transactions. They can be complicated because, just as an example, maybe a automotive company will sell 10 oil changes for it normally would cost $300. They say we will sell this for $200 rather than $300. So you pay the customer pays the price and gets the voucher, and they can get those oil changes wherever they want. So they could be going to various states where they're actually obtaining the service. Some states like North Dakota tax the parts, but not the labor. Some tax, you know, so those types of transactions get to be complicated situations. And so the states are working on a system to deal with those so that they can be uniform and the companies that are offering those discount vouchers know how to handle them. Another project is the sourcing of services, which really has little impact on North Dakota because we don't tax many services, but a lot of states tax, you know, legal services, all kinds of services. There again, inconsistency between the states or determining where the service is received and where it should be subject to tax, and so that is a topic of discussion. Sourcing of digital goods is another project that's going on, which also really has no impact on North Dakota because we have a law that exempts the sale of digital products, and so there shouldn't be any impact there. Kind of a subset of that digital goods is remote access to software. That's a complicated issue because you can have a software product sitting on a server somewhere and you can have people from various states accessing it at the same time, or you can buy a service where you can have multiple customers using it from different places at different times, and it gets to be complicated as far as who gets the tax and so on. So that's another area that's being worked on. As far as legislation for 2013, as you probably all know, in the past we've had a substantial amount of legislation in order to stay in compliance with the agreement. It's going to be very limited this time around. There have been a couple of amendments to the agreement that have been passed that we will incorporate into our law. One of them is the definition of sales price and what is subject to tax, and it involves when a tax is imposed on the seller of a product. And for example, in North Dakota, we have a 2% telecommunications tax that is imposed on the telecommunications provider rather than on the final customer. You will see that in most cases, the telecommunications company passes that through to the customer and itemizes it on their bill, but it's really a tax to the seller rather than to the customer. That is part of the selling price. Really, what this definition of sales price will do is clarify what taxes are included in the sales price and what are not. It really won't change what we tax. It'll just make it more clear for the sellers out there and the customers to know whether those things should be subject to tax. The other item, the other amendment to the agreement that's been passed involves origin sourcing. North Dakota sources sales to where the product is delivered or where the customer takes possession of it. There are some states that tax based on where the seller is located if it's an intrastate, a sale within the state. There was a recent amendment to the agreement that allows origin sourcing. That'll impact Ohio and Utah, but not North Dakota. But because we've incorporated major sections of the agreement into our law, we'll still update our law with those changes, even though they won't have any impact. The other possible item that we could have would be credit for taxes paid to another state, which is the project that I referred to that we're working on right now. There may be something in the agreement that would be finalized before the session that we would want to incorporate into our law, but really the changes should be relatively limited this year. And that's what I wanted to report as far as what's going on in Streamline. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to try to address them.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chairman. Under what legal authority does a retailer have the ability to voluntarily collect and remit taxes? I mean, you know, he's just taking that money from his customers and giving to his state. Does he actually have legal authority to do that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nelson, I think they do. In a lot of cases, what happens is customers want the retailer to collect the tax from them. And so they say, I don't want to have to keep track of this and then report the use tax to my state. I would rather you collect it from me and then it's done. And so, a lot of companies will do that just because their customers prefer. Of course, it's better for the state if they do, because a lot of times the use taxes don't get reported and remitted, and so there's an advantage to the state, too, in getting the revenue that...
I'm just kind of wondering if it opens up those retailers to a class action suit that they collected several million dollars that they had no legal authority to collect.
I guess that's a question for the attorneys rather than me, Representative Nelson. I do think it's tax that's owed, but it's not like they are collecting taxes that the customer doesn't legally owe. It's just a matter of who collects it and remits it.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, before any company has the ability to collect tax for another state, I collect tax for the state of Minnesota. Before I can do that, I have to get a sales tax permit from the state of Minnesota. So the state of Minnesota knows that I am doing so, and the state, and then I also subject myself to an audit from the state of Minnesota to make sure that I am collecting and remitting taxes that are owed to Minnesota and only Minnesota. So it starts with a permit.
Thank you. Anything else for Miles? Thank you, Miles.
Thank you.
Well, committee discussion, direction for council.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kelsch.
Could I ask a question on how much bonded indebtedness is not voted on by the people of that local subdivision, like school districts, if they're going to build a building, that's voted on by the people, and it takes 60%. Is there any bonded indebtedness that is not voted on by the people?
Well, like special assessment debt, that is not voted on, but it's also not a general obligation of all of the voters, just the benefited properties.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Frosa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wouldn't any building authorities that use that authority to bond for a building project, wouldn't that be an indebtedness that's not voted on by the public?
Yep.
And that could amount to quite a substantial loan or indebtedness.
And revenue bonds, I'm not sure. I don't recall if there's a vote requirement.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, on this debt thing, I also had the question about, I know every 2 years at least, a political subdivision has to have an audit. And I was pretty sure that the debt is part of that audit and that you have to report that audit goes to the state auditor. I mean, doesn't the state auditor actually have all this information if he wants to?
Well, before we adjourn, I just want to have everybody take notice of the note on the bottom. You're all welcome to tour stamping operations at AMCOM if you have the time. So with that, I guess we'll adjourn the meeting.